At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and every body. The weather is getting warmer and it's time to swap my winter layers for fun, vibrant, and cool clothing. With so many fun things happening this spring, like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, it's hard to find great looking clothes that fit you just right. That's why I love JCPenney. JCPenney has so many stylish and comfortable options for so many different body types. I've been blown away by their selection and everything hugs my body in all the right spots. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with style that gets you. Something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Today, I'm really excited to have Dr. Keltner on the show. Professor Keltner is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, where he is co-director of the Greater Good Science Center and where he investigates the social functions of emotion. His book is Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Thanks for being on the podcast today, Doctor.
It's good to be here, Scott.
Yeah, I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, a big admirer of your work. So I wanted to start by tracing the history of your research interests, because is it true you started studying negative emotions?
I did. I spent a lot of time studying shame and embarrassment and anger and fear, and like a lot of the field, you know, in a science of emotion after a postdoc with Paul Ekman, and I was making a lot of progress on those. And then for accidental reasons, you know, the kind of the yearbook photo study that I did with Ravenna Helsin that looked at the predictive power of smiles in young women's lives and how it predicts later outcomes in life. And then working with George Bonanno on the function of laughter during really traumatic times like bereavement, I started to get interested in positive states. And just from there, it opened up really dramatically.
Yeah. And around this time you're studying this, was the field of positive psychology in existence yet as a thing?
It was. You know, I mean, it was, you know, this is like the late 1990s,
okay.
And early, really about that time period when positive psychology and Barb Fredrickson's paper in particular, Rod and Bell Thinking, kind of was this revolutionary argument that we just need to take a whole new perspective on the positive states that make up our life. And she offered one taxonomy. And then as I was doing the Darwinian science of emotional expression and universality, yeah, there's a whole space of emotion from, you know, awe to laughter to love to kindness and compassion that needed to be looked at through the kind of the emotion science lens.
That's great. Yeah. And it's great that you've tackled a lot of emotions that haven't really traditionally been gotten a lot of research attention. So three in particular that I find really interesting: love, compassion, and awe.
Yeah.
How is love different from compassion?
Well, you know, I was really inspired by Bowlby's argument, right? And Bowlby, in his thinking about attachment and loss and grief, you know, is this really radical theorist, and he was combining evolutionary thinking with Freudian thinking in the 60s. And he said, look, you know, our social connections can be broken down to a few different types. One is caring and the provision of nurturance to small, vulnerable beings, right? And that, when I read that, that felt like compassion, just at its very core. It's about caregiving. And then love is really more horizontal. It's more between equals. And it really is about enduring commitment and attachment. And then in Bowlby's framework, and then the frameworks that followed, between, you know, friends and reproductive partners. So that's a ground for differentiating the two. And then you can start to differentiate them in terms of display behavior. You know, compassion is really sort of a soothing, nurturant kind of display. Love is more open and affiliative and affectionate.
And I really want to dive deeper into that. Would you say compassion is a necessary sufficient for love? Can you have love without compassion?
I think so. I mean, you know, if you go back to John Bowlby, he said that that intimate family life and intimate social connection is founded on a few basic processes, right? One is caring for vulnerable offspring. And our offspring are, you know, they're more vulnerable than any mammal on the face of the earth. The second is long-term commitments that you really need to stay connected to a reproductive partner to get those vulnerable offspring off the ground. And the third is reproductive behavior, sexual behavior. That was Bowlby's argument, and we took that very literally and said, those functional arguments should help us differentiate love, which is about attachment, from compassion, which is really about caring, from sexual desire, which is a reproductive-related emotion. And a lot of the data we've gathered that I write about in Born to Be Good speaks to that. And then I think, to your question, Scott, I think you can care independent of feeling love in the moment, right? So I will have spontaneous feelings of care for vulnerable children,
right,
who might not even be my kin, and that'll produce pro-social behavior that then lays the foundation for love. So love isn't a precondition for caring, and caring isn't a precondition for love. I think that our love of romantic partners often happens pretty independently of our exchange of caring.
Fascinating. I think a lot about love from like a humanistic psychology perspective, like the will to love, role, may, and stuff. That there's very much there's passion, but there's also very much a willful component to it. You know, it's not easy. It's not easy.
Yeah.
And to help want and care and want someone to grow, to help someone grow, it's kind of like I view love almost as a mindset,
you know,
or a way of being. And yeah, so I like that, making that distinction. It's not one that's often made in the scientific literature. You often see compassion folded in under love, or kind of treated synonymously, right?
I think your point is even more fundamental, that we have to recognize that love, you know, we have these models of love that are based on teenage love, pyrotechnics, and early romance. And love, it lasts a long time, right? In a lot of our lives, we stay married to somebody or in a romantic partnership with somebody for a long time. And those emotional dynamics are hard, they change, they soften, they transform. And I challenge my undergrads today at Berkeley who are 18, 19 years old, and I tell them, like, look, you know, you think of love as one thing today, and it's rooted in desire and physical passion, but it's going to change profoundly, and it will be the hardest emotion you will have to cultivate over your lifetime.
Yeah.
For the reasons you're talking about.
Yeah, because you have to cultivate it. Yeah.
You do.
Yeah. So then where does all fit in? Because all is this something greater than ourselves. And yet there seems to be a link with compassion. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. So
it's your idea.
Well, the way that we think about these emotions, the positive emotions that I write about in Born to Be Good, and that we're studying scientifically, awe, compassion, love, gratitude, desire, mirth, or amusement, is they all serve different purposes in our highly complex, hypersocial life.
Yeah.
And awe, one of the amazing things about humans is we are a cultural animal, you know, and we fold into tribes, we fold into collectives, we adopt the principles and values and manners of other people. And there are a lot of sacrifices involved in becoming part of a collective. We'll often sacrifice ourselves for the collective.
Mm.
And so what John Hyde and I argued in an early paper on awe is that the experience of awe, when you feel that you're in the presence of something bigger than yourself that you don't understand, really at its core is about committing to your social collective, right?
Mm.
Whereas compassion orients you to take care of vulnerable beings around you. And love is about egalitarian partnerships, awe sort of takes the individual and embeds it in social networks and social collectives. And we have a lot of data that fits that thesis. When we feel awe, we get more altruistic. We think of ourselves as more connected to others. We become more humble. So it is this collective emotion, as Durkheim once argued.
Wow. You know, I'm trying to think of Paul Bloom's argument, that the case against empathy.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to tie this all together. So my one question to help me tie this together is, do you make a distinction in your work between compassion and empathy?
Yeah, you have to. You know, empathy, understanding what other people feel, feeling what other people feel, is different from compassion, which is I want to ameliorate the suffering of others. And in fact, neural data show empathy involves parts of the frontal lobes. Compassion involves the periaqueductal gray, which is a very old region near the brainstem. So they're very separate.
So with that said, I would predict scientifically that empathy would be much less correlated with awe than compassion would be correlated with awe.
Yeah, I think that's a really cool idea, Scott. And I think
based on Paul Broom's work, yeah.
Our data show that awe tends to correlate with compassion. Experiences of awe make people feel more compassionate towards others, right? Very often, experiences of profound compassion, say when you see someone really suffering, or you see, you know, a famine and the victims of a famine, will often trigger feelings of kind of a more fearful form of awe. So very often, compassion and awe are tightly connected to each other.
Yeah, because there is this kind of getting outside of yourself aspect that empathy doesn't have.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, fundamentally.
It's like a higher level cognitive representation, you know, just to get nerdy for a second, and, you know, like we evolved. It seems like compassion is a more recently evolved, you know, the cognitive mechanisms that support compassion are more uniquely developed in humans.
Well, there I would diverge, which it's interesting, and this is where neuroscientific data are useful. We, led by Emiliana Simon-Thomas, did an imaging study. And when you see images of suffering, it activates old regions of your brainstem, the periaqueductal gray. By contrast, when you understand the mental state of another person, that actually activates regions of the empathy network, which are in the frontal lobes, which is really different. So I think we would make the case for just the opposite. That
wow.
I know.
Well,
that's why we did the neuroscience, right? Most people think compassion is really complex and has all these moral calculations or utilitarian calculations. But in fact, responding to the needs and suffering of others is very, very basic in the brain.
Doctor, we need to link up, man. There's this work that Mary Helen and Merdino Yang is doing. I'm showing linking compassion to a default mode network.
Nice.
Brain activity. And she's found that the more, you know, she shows all these vignettes of like the suffering of, you know, like a mother making a sacrifice for a poor child of food. And she found in the scanner that the more that people have time to reflect on the connection between what's going on and their own personal life, the greater the activity in the default mode network, and also the more compassionate and abstractly complex the response is.
Nice.
So I wonder if all these things could interact, and like maybe what you're saying is true, but maybe it's also true that you can add additional layers of uniquely human cognitive representations to even get more cognitively abstract.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And it's important to remember, you know, there are certain elicitors of compassion that are very simple, old,
right,
stimuli.
Right.
We use images of suffering, right?
Yeah.
Suffering faces. And when you get into scenarios that are in the written word, that's just inherently more symbolic and complex. But I think, you know, a lot of people like Peter Singer wrote about,
right,
you know, there are simpler forms of compassion and caring, which is like, my baby is suffering. That's fundamental. And then there are these more abstract, complex forms of compassion.
Good. Like,
I care about literary figures or people in another part of the world. And so they're going to be these really interesting interactions that we're just starting to understand.
Good. This is great. All this neuroscience research needs like kind of an integrative model. And
I agree.
Yeah, so this is a great conversation. So return to awe for a second. Something that's really interesting is implications for education. You know, there's this nature deficit disorder. I don't know if you've heard of that phrase. And there's also research linking, by the way, awe and nature with creativity, a topic I'm personally interested in. So what do you think there could be implications for increasing creativity in schools?
Well, I think they're massive. And, you know, I've just been reading about it is very widely assumed, not widely assumed, it's a common assertion that when we feel awe and wonder, which is a little like the mental state of marveling over things, that triggers very deep thinking. We have data, as yet unpublished, but replicated many times, that if I feel a lot of awe, I engage in more rigorous scientific reasoning. Right. So there's argument and evidence that awe is really good for scholarship and for reasoning about the world. And regrettably, you know, most educators, and we work with a lot of educators at the Greater Good Science Center, feel like that's been taken out of their school day. You know, that they just don't have the time for kids to wander and wonder and get out in nature and get their hands dirty like Charles Darwin did. And I think this is one of the platforms for rethinking our education. The kids need free time. They need to get outdoors. And then I also feel, you know, we're doing a lot of work now with the Sierra Club and Stacey Bear, looking at how outdoor excursions are good for kids in terms of their, you know, and other people like Francis Kuo have been interested in this, just ability to concentrate, interest in the world, curiosity about things, open-minded inquiry, yeah. Or finding really compelling data. So I think the awe wonder angle is a really important sort of basis for thinking about where we can improve contemporary education.
I just love that.
My kids are kind of in the, you know, they're in the hyper-competitive world now. They're in public schools, but they're trying to get into good colleges. And how hard they're working just on tests, right, when just it countervails their curiosity. And I find that sad.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who's been all inspired by taking the SATs. I can't think of anyone.
And that's proof in its own right.
It really is.
Yeah.
What about implications for therapy, for like clinical psychologists and incorporating all into therapy?
Well, you know, I've spoken a lot to therapists just, you know, in my travels, and they talk a lot about this, that, you know, first of all, that when you're lacking awe about the world or wonder, it's a really sad sign of poor adjustment, right? That you're just not marveling at the sunset or a friend's generosity or the pattern of light on the ground. So that's telling. And they also talk about how when people really make progress therapeutically, there are these epiphanies involved, you know, which is a form of awe. It's like, my God, I did not realize that this motif was so central to my life and my dad's life and his dad's life. Mm. And you just get into this more wonder-filled mindset where you're a little more forgiving of your own flaws in your character. So they very routinely mention that great therapy is rocket boosted by awe, which is an interesting connection.
I love that. So maybe some aspiring clinical psychologists listening to this podcast might be inspired to go more into this awe-based therapy practice.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Scott. In my work with the Sierra Club, one of the groups that we're getting outdoors and studying scientifically is veterans. And we, you know, we have over 2 million veterans. A lot of them are suffering profoundly.
Yeah.
A lot of them are young people who love challenge and the great outdoors. And talk therapy may be a little counterintuitive, right? Or less accessible. Not accessible, less just something that they wouldn't gravitate to intuitively. And we're getting amazing findings on the benefits, just getting outdoors and feeling awe. So I think there are a lot of therapeutic opportunities with experiences of awe.
Good. That's very exciting. It's a very exciting area of inquiry. So I want to talk about some other emotions. I mean, you cover, you basically study them all. You study
them. I do.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing off limits for you. You know, let me just jump right. I want to jump to teasing. Can we talk about teasing for a second? I was going to leave that for the end, but I want to jump right to that. So teasing is expressing potentially embarrassing affections. What's the association there?
Well, you know, teasing is a way in which we bring up taboo subjects with other people, right? So let's say I want to express affection with somebody I'm flirting with.
Yeah.
And it's risky. Or let's say I want to express affection for a friend, just to praise them, but you don't want to praise them directly. Or let's say I want to offer some suggestions or critiques to somebody because they've acted inappropriately. Those are all potentially embarrassing, awkward, fraught situations. And around the world, in every language that's been studied, from hunter-gatherers to Philadelphia, people tease each other, right? They joke and they make indirect comments and they exaggerate stuff to express these awkward affections toward one another. And the art of that, or the purpose, is just to soften the trickiness of conveying those messages.
Hmm. I want to ask you a question that integrates various strands of your research. So let me know if this question makes sense.
Sure.
Does the ability to tease require access to your self-conscious emotions? Because do children with autism have difficulty with teasing?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know where you got that question. But that's
I just suddenly just came up with it.
Yeah, no, it's really cool because you're right. And, you know, it's interesting. Teasing, you know, it's always, I know a lot of people feel hesitant about teasing because it can really be hurtful, right?
Yeah.
And I would call that bullying or just more straightforward aggression. And in Born to be Good, and then in our scientific work, we have a framework for sort of classifying teases as friendly and fun or aggressive and offensive. But, you know, the great teasing begins in an appreciation of how other people might get embarrassed,
right?
Or how their feelings might get hurt, or they might feel ashamed. And then we deliver the message that could be embarrassing in a really playful, indirect, goofy way, and suddenly we're laughing about human foibles. We've got two pieces of data that fit your thesis. High-functioning Asperger's kids have, you know, they have trouble with self-conscious emotions, understanding them, like embarrassment, and they have trouble with teasing. Their teasing is more direct, it isn't as playful, so evidence one. And then we've also studied people who have, later in life, have a form of brain dementia that hits the orbital frontal lobes, or they have a head trauma, or they have kind of a loss of neurons in the orbital frontal cortex. They too have trouble understanding embarrassment. And we did a study and their teasing is really inappropriate. You know, it's too sexually suggestive, it's too direct, it's impulsive. So I think great teasing begins in appreciating that you might embarrass other people.
What a great question. So let's add in psychopaths here for a second.
Yeah.
Do psychopaths tease less? And do they experience embarrassment at all?
You know, I don't know of any study that's looked at that. And
has anyone ever asked that question before?
Yeah, it's a really important question. You know, Hare had this early thinking about psychopaths that they just don't feel guilt or remorse, right. Or which is another self-conscious emotion.
So. Right. I don't want to ask the psychopaths. But yeah, so well, you brought up guilt, and there seems to be a link between guilt and pro-sociality. Is that right?
Yeah, there is.
And why? Why is there a link there?
When you have done things to make you feel guilt, typically it's you've harmed someone else, or maybe there's harm in the world you've created and your reputation is jeopardized. And so given that, guilt, the studies show, tends to make you more pro-social, you're more altruistic. Studies find, it's really interesting that this is, I think, Cameron Anderson or Frank Flynn, that if I tend to be a little bit prone to guilt, I'm a better leader, right? Because I'm kind of worried about hurting other people's feelings. And as a result, I do things that are better for leadership. So it's a really undervalued emotion in our culture.
Well, you know, Well, this is interesting because the leadership, you study power as well, right?
Yeah, and that's my more recent book, The Power Paradox.
Exactly.
You know, you get power by advancing the welfare of others and sharing resources,
right,
and expressing gratitude, Adam Grant's work and others.
Right.
And then power, once we feel above people, we feel privileged or we're invincible, we act like jerks, you know? And that's why I think this is in the footnotes of The Power Paradox. Guilt is a really important emotion to be looking for in leaders, which is, are they going to correct themselves if they make mistakes, if they invest all of your money in a risky move and blow it? Are they going to figure out ways to make amends for the damages? So it's a counterintuitively important emotion for effective power.
Super interesting. Although there are certainly cases where a lot of people who are jerks in power were jerks when they were born. Right?
Yeah, but those are, you know, I think those are less typical than you might imagine.
Okay.
Right? I think the more common trajectory is that you start out being interested in other people in power, kind of brings out the bad in human nature. You know, even when you study like Joseph Stalin, it really was power that turned him into a madman. You know, a lot of historians, when they look at Hitler's early life, he was kind of an awkward, weird person, right? Artistic sensibilities. But power turned him into one of the world's worst madmen. So I think it's more common
that
power does the bad work to you.
I want to believe that. Apparently you do a Trump impersonation, is that right?
I'm still here, even if I'm out of the shot.
Who told you that?
you said it.
That's, by the way, that's Elizabeth Hyde's voice on the
publicly
podcast. So apparently you did a Trump impersonation. Can you do that for us?
Okay, so I'll take my glasses off. So but it actually relates to a scientific finding.
Yep.
So, you know, my new book, The Power Paradox, I write about how everybody thinks that people rise in power by being Machiavellian and narcissistic. But the data don't line up with that thinking. That instead, as we've been talking, Scott, what the data show is once I have power, I become narcissistic and Machiavellian. And so my colleague, Leanne Tambrinke, and I just published a paper in Psychological Science to really test this for the first time in a very direct way. And we looked at U.S. senators. We coded their nonverbal behavior for narcissistic tendencies and also courageous, humane tendencies, where you just show caring for other people. And we found that the courageous senators in their nonverbal behavior got more support for the bills they were trying to get passed, right? And the narcissistic Machiavellian senators got less support. So that strategy cost them. And here comes the Trump imitation. One of the key nonverbal expressions of narcissism looks like this.
but guests can't see that.
What?
Wait, dude, one more time. Do it one more time. I'm going to take a screen capture and put it on the podcast notes. Okay, good. I got it.
And what was great is the science showed that those Machiavellian narcissists in the Senate, no one liked them. They didn't want to support their bills. They weren't influential, so another reason to be skeptical of Trump candidacy.
Absolutely. Oh, that's great. I'm going to put that in the show notes, that picture of you doing a Trump present. So that's super interesting. And this, well, you know, I love taking a Maslow point of view. And he talked about esteem needs. And I would put power within the, you know, I put as in within the class of esteem needs. And it's important. You're kind of saying like, look, you know, this is actually like a fundamental human need. And that when we kind of get addicted to that satisfying that need, or we get it, you know, too much, then that can actually turn us into a-holes.
Yeah, you know, and it's going to be so, I think your rethinking of Maslow is going to be so important for our culture.
Oh, wow. That means so much that you said that.
Because, you know, what the new neuroscience is showing is that a lot of our social needs are on par with sleeping and near eating, you know, nearly as powerful as eating. One of them being caring for others, you know, it's so striking. Compassion activates old regions of the brain. So it's old evolutionarily. And another is status. And, you know, William James, there's no deeper craving that we have than to have the appreciation of other people.
Yeah.
And there's amazing work by Keeley Muscatel. And I write about this in The Power Paradox, showing we hunger for the respect of other people.
Yeah.
And she shows, if I hear kind words about my reputation from a friend, it activates these safety networks in the brain, which are activated when we feel safe physically.
Yeah.
So it tells us that social safety and inclusion is on par with physical safety. And that drives us, like you were very aptly saying, to go after attention and respect and power. And then the trouble is, once we feel powerful, we lose sight of the very things that got us the status and respect of others in the first place.
I could have said it better myself. I love that. And it does seem to be this cycle. And, you know, the narcissism, you know, Baumeister has this model that narcissism is an addiction to self-esteem.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an interesting way of thinking of these maladaptive. There's a point at which things just become maladaptive, I guess.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
So let's talk about morality. I think that transitions nicely from power to morality.
Yeah.
What is naive realism?
Yeah, naive realism is so important. It's a concept that my advisor, Lee Ross at Stanford, thought about, and Solomon Ash, who used to be at Penn, or Swarthmore, talked about, and others. And naive realism is the idea that we see the world subjectively. And that's one of the fundamental insights of psychology, right? Is that, you know, I see food and friends and social situations and rainbows and politics and presidential debates through my own subjective lens of emotion and history and the like. So truth is subjective, but we fail to appreciate that. We are naively assume that we look at the world realistically, and that's fine, but it gets us into trouble when suddenly somebody has a different point of view about the presidential debate or about the merits of a movie or what have you, and we are struck that someone else could look at reality, which seems so truthful to us, in a different way.
Right.
And what happens is really predictable, and we showed this in early research that, you know, because I assume I see the world as it is, if I encounter somebody who sees it differently, I think they're irrational. I think they're dangerous. I think that they are problematic. And this is why, you know, some of the discussions today about making sure we allow for free, open speech, this is really important because we have to, at the foundation is respect, and it's counterintuitive because of naive realism.
Yeah. And also we have these biases to privilege our own point of view or our own perspective. And I just think this relates as well to Kistanovich's work on rationality and how rational thinkers have that ability to inhibit their own perspective, which is activated by default. And
Nate, yeah, that makes a very nice connection. I made that. That's really cool.
Yeah. So you've studied three different moral domains: autonomy, community, and purity. How does that relate to Jonathan Haidt's domains?
Yeah, well, very much so, you know, and I know, you know, John and I have been old friends, and we, you know, did our work on Awe together.
I know.
Some writings.
I asked you a leading question.
And John is one of the most creative minds I've ever been around. And John and I, at the time, were hanging around as young scholars. He was a postdoc, and I was a young professor at Wisconsin. And Rick Schwader and Paul Rosin were starting to think about broadening our thinking of, with respect to morality beyond Kohlberg, harm, rights, justice, to purity, sexual stuff, community, which is the sense of being embedded in a system of duties and roles and the like. And so, you know, autonomy, I think, I forgot what John's calling it now, so divinity clearly maps to purity in his model.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And then autonomy is really about freedom and liberty.
Yeah.
And then community, it's got a little bit of authority in there, and obligate, I forgot what his, so those are kind of the original foundations that John then branches off into different tributaries. So yeah, it's a foundation of his work.
As well as yours, and these three more.
Yeah, you know, my approach, and it very much, you know, and we've done a lot of work in this space, and it complements John's intellectual work, or it buttresses it, is, you know, we take a view of Martha Nussbaum and David right. Hume and Charles Darwin and others that emotions guide or drive moral judgment, right? You know, one of my favorite examples is Thomas Clarkson. I was talking about this with somebody earlier who was critiquing emotions as a form of rationality. Thomas Clarkson was a college student in 18th century England. And when he thought about the slave trade and Africans on the bottom of those slave ships dying, British people didn't know about this, he literally collapsed off and fell off his horse in an emotional recognition of what was going on, a sympathetic breakthrough, right? He's like, my God, there's so much suffering in slavery. It just knocked him out. He fainted out of that emotion. And out of that experience, he helped really develop the abolitionist movement and led to the end of slavery. So emotions drive reasoning in that sense. And so we've done a lot of work on how compassion makes us connect to fellow human beings, how awe makes us humble and share resources, how gratitude is an engine of reciprocity and trade between non-kin. And I think that those findings align with Haidt's really important work of kind of the intuitive old foundations of moral behavior and action.
Absolutely. And you also see a connection there with sympathy breakthroughs, how it's just so poignant, you know, how they trained the Nazis to, and they had to practice themselves to get rid of their compassion. And the flip side of this is when you are in war and you look your enemy in the eye and you have this sympathy breakthrough, you say, you know, you put down your gun. You say, I just can't, you know what? I can't kill my fellow human.
And yeah, you know, that is the historian's observation. And it blew me away that in combat, people routinely suffer because of the sympathy they feel for their adversaries who are being hurt. And there's all this new work coming out, and I work a lot with veterans, and you just sense it to be true that, you know, this idea of moral harm and moral injury, very powerful, that when you hurt somebody, it destroys the moral fabric of your identity. That has to be, and I think sympathy is right at the core of it, tells out how powerful that sentiment is. You can't just root it out as you might intuit to get into combat.
Yeah, so ending this whole interview today on that note, a kind of basic point there is we are wired to care in lots of ways. Yeah. We're wired for compassion. There's a lot of good that's built into the system that you can't just evolutionarily reduce everything to one of these world order or some sort of selfish motivation. And even Darwin himself talked about compassion as being one of the most powerful human emotions. So,
yeah, and I remember being on a panel with the Dalai Lama and
I think you're going to say with Darwin.
That'd be almost as good as being on the panel, or just as good. You know, it was as early in my career, and we were talking about compassion, and he said, you know, compassion is a basic setting of the human mind. And I think that the data that continue to come in that I talk about in Born to Be Good and elsewhere show we have a very deep intuitive tendency to take care of others, and society needs to make the most of that.
That's wonderful. Thanks for the great work you do and for chatting with me today.
It's great to be with you, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can visit thepsychologypodcast.com.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.